All right, so I've made a point on this presentation to emphasize the word snapshot, because really, I thought about it. Snapshot is all I can ever give. Even when I have exhibitions, which I just had one that just closed, I always, you know, unlike a published thing where you have a true endpoint, kind of a closure, for me, even an exhibition is a snapshot. And so that's what I'm going to talk about, where I am, what got me here, and where I'm heading. Okay, so this is a shot here of my studio, just taken about 2 or 3 days ago. So there's been a little change there since, but that's close to it. So I'm bringing this up because to anyone who happened to have seen my last presentation, which I'm just going to rough guess was 2 years ago, on that particular one, I was really talking about my expanded diagram project. So this one is different. I'm wearing a different hat. However, I should say that that project's still alive and well for me, and I'm continuing to work on it. And I'm bringing this one up because this is most of my activities there are through blog postings. And this is a recent one I just posted, and I'm bringing this up as well. I'm not going to go through this, but it's stephenbarris.com blog if you ever want to actually read it. But this continually discontinuous is actually, I picked this and I seek these artists out because it was something intriguing in my own work. And sometimes I find I understand what I'm doing by looking at how it's playing out in other people's work. So really what this is kind of a meditation on their work and how continuity and discontinuity play themselves out in visual art, superficially, as we can call it composition, but to me it's far more than composition. I think composition is kind of a stand-in for much deeper issues that are being played out. And so really what this blog posting was kind of a deep dive into that through these three separate artists. But again, it's something very important to my current work. But anyway, but first I'm going to go back up a little bit. Again, it's really difficult for me, and I will say excruciating for me, to try to explain myself as an artist. Again, I can explain other people much better than myself, but what I'm going back, so I do a lot of stuff. Most of what I'm presently doing would go under the general heading of painting, but in fact, a lot of my work over the years has involved photo documentary, video, graphic design, installations and such. And in particular, one general project that kind of leads, there's a through line between that and what I'm doing today is this one, although it may not look so obvious at the moment. This was a project a few years back. It took a few years, and it was about called Exurban Archipelago was the thing. And I had several exhibitions featuring this project, again, involving documentation. And you could see there's a game board I actually designed. And really it was about Exurbia, the Exurbia that I was initially experiencing not so far from where I presently live, and just how placeless it is. How disorienting it is to be in those places fascinated me in a kind of a fun way, but strange way. So anyway, I started really focusing on distribution centers. And at the time, that's kind of what they're all being called. Amazon has come along now and turned distribution centers into something super big and sexy because they're called fulfillment centers now. But back then, they were just sort of, well, they've always been around, but they were really starting to pop up in a big way around major cities. And so I would go and take video and photography. My wife, Linda, would be driving, and we'd go through these vast complexes, and I would be driving through them, honestly wondering why I wasn't arrested. Honestly, there must have been, who knows what were in some of these buildings? Could have been military secrets, I don't know. I was always expecting at some point to be arrested by somebody. And I was always ready to show them with a laptop that I'm an artist and I have a website and all that, hoping that'll get me out of jail. But fortunately, I was never arrested. But so anyway, so this whole project was moving into a whole lot of different areas. For example, I was doing a lot of prints. A lot of these things were created using Google Earth, and then I would bring it in Photoshop and play with them. Again, really looking at the structures, the spatial dispositions of these massive buildings and the complexes themselves and their context in a larger environment that they were in. I found them very scary, but very fascinating. So anyway, so that led to two or three exhibitions, including this one. In fact, you can see that same game board there, which, by the way, lots of people played. It's an actual game that you could play. It was called Take a Load Off, and it was really really who could get through this exurban world, especially one of these distribution centers, get through it alive first. That was the goal of the game. So in that, you could see behind it was a large mural that I painted for this exhibition. And also, this was an early stages of some of my plexiglass work. So this was also in that exhibition, a whole series of plexiglass, as well as video. And I'll just show you a tiny bit of this, but not all of it by any means. But this was actually in one of those shows, and it was a looping video. So it has a bit of a jump at the beginning, but I'll just go for 20 seconds of it. But what I was doing on this one was I had actually did a lot of, spent a lot of time near the site of that exhibition at a complex of distribution centers only a few miles away. It was in Wilmington, Delaware. It was actually the Delaware Center of Contemporary Art. It was where it was shown. But anyway, so this is just me driving and driving and driving and driving. And then what you see on the left are basically series of these Google Earth-based shots that I essentially turned into an animation. So this is, like I say, this was in an exhibition. It was a looping thing, as loops go. So anyway, it was fun, but this, I think, was like about a 3-minute thing, but good enough for now. Maybe just a little bit more. So I just love the bays of these things. They're just something mesmerizing about being in those worlds. But like I say, very disorienting, very placeless. That's the word that comes to mind. Anyway, so that led, clearly working with video, I was working with video editing programs, or a program, Final Cut Pro was mine. And I started really getting fascinated by the timelines, that's what it was called, of, you know, just the basic idea that motion, this illusion of continuous motion is in fact an illusion, right? It's just a series of frames next to each other. So I started to play with those frames and sort of pull different ones out and reconstruct them to create whole new thing. So at this point, I'm kind of phasing out of that strong theme, although I'm still kind of tie into it once in a while, the distribution centers, and kind of going a little more abstract and more conceptual now. So that sort of led to a whole, I mean, I'm jumping over a lot of work here, but for example, this is a series. I had an exhibition, actually it was the fall right in New York, right before the pandemic. This is called Chunk Chain, it was a series. So you can kind of see how this eventually kind of led to that in my painting. So this is an actual painting here. Second one here. And really that was not so long before the pandemic set in. And then this pandemic set in. And I, like so many people, were fairly isolated. And fortunately my studio is my home. And so I just started playing around. And again, I'm not a huge installation artist, and I'm certainly not a sophisticated one, but I just happen to have a studio just loaded with cinder blocks that I use all the time, and I just started playing around with them and really fascinated with it, sort of a kind of a metaphor for a destabilized moment, or a moment that's very precarious, that's still in balance, but on the verge of losing balance, which felt that year to be the case with the pandemic and the and the Black Lives Matter situations that rose. So this really became one of the things that started to influencing the work of my pandemic year. Another example. Again, I was just playing around with all kinds of stuff. What do? You know, you have a lot of time on your hands. So you play with cinder blocks. But then at the same time, similar to that other little body of work, it too led it back into the painting. In fact, they were happening simultaneously. So again, a clear linkage between what I was playing with and with three-dimensional forms and two-dimensional paintings. And that led directly to an exhibition that just ended in New York that was titled Toppling, which I thought was an appropriate title for that. So you could see The gallerist actually wanted me and really wanted me to put some of my cinder blocks in the gallery. And I just kept saying, are you sure? Do you have a rider on your insurance policy? Do you have small children that will go into there and play with this? So I put a very tame version in there. There's a little bit of precarity going on, but let's face it, you'd have to work pretty hard to knock it over. So that was a corner of that exhibition. And again, it just ended a week ago. So you could see a couple of shots from that exhibition. This two is from that. And so again, these were all just called the Toplin series.
Steve, Mike, I would like to hear from you something about like the emotional component of this project. And by emotional, I mean, or I refer to what you mentioned about being scary, but also fascinated with these sites. You also mentioned that you were worried to be arrested by the police.
Or security guards, sure.
Yeah. So that's a lot of tension.
Yeah.
And we see that tension in your, not only in the diagrammatic thinking, but the way you're like trying to balance things that are out of balance
themselves.
So I would like to, if you can say something, like say more about the emotions that are at stake here, as I'm like becoming more interested in how the body and the emotions are like like taking on the type of work we develop that we think is abstract, that we think that is separate, that we think that is that hasn't anything to do with the body. But right on the contrary, you began your presentation saying that about going out and mapping and all this fear of taking pictures that maybe for other people or for another artist that may be disconnected from the spaces will feel just cool.
Sure, right.
In fact, have this in your presentation.
Right. And in fact, I would say to add to your word cool, I'm gonna put that word designy, right? Because design, as much as I appreciate design and operate and I actually teach it, it's also a way of whitewashing reality. In other words, a great designer or graphic designer, I'll keep it just at that at this point, but you know, can take anything and just make it look cool, you know, make it just because of the devices of great graphic design, the devices of composition and all that kind of stuff can really tame reality in ways. But aside from that, getting back to the emotional thing, I mean, there's no question. And by the way, that also what you said in terms of taking what seems like diagrammatic or I'll put the word formal thinking, because in visual art, we talk about formal versus content-based. A lot of that blog posting I did that I referred to, the continuity, discontinuity blog posting, is only ostensibly about continuity and discontinuity, but rather about taking a deep dive and really getting below what seems superficial formalism, but below simple superficial composition into what I think are truly bodily things. I talk about it in there. I absolutely refer to body, about space, and about how at the end of the day, a viewer, if it is resonating with you, it's probably resonating on some pre-conscious level of bodily experience in space. Maybe it's, and that leads me to that, this project we're now talking about, that Zurban Archipelago. What fascinated me and what was emotional to me was, and I've used this word, and I'll use it again, was the sense of disorientation, dislocation. And a lot of that comes from my own biography. I mean, I literally grew up on Indian reservations. That's what they're called then, out west, because my father worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, in places that had 200 or 300 people. It was, if nothing else, it was a place, right? The idea of place was never questioned, okay? But of course, as I get older, I go off to college, I eventually move to this very crowded Eastern seaboard, and I'm suddenly throwing myself out, not just the suburbs. I find the suburbs actually aren't that placeless because they're oriented toward a city center. They were encircling cities. It's the exurbs that I'm fascinated with. They don't orient to anything other than expressway complexes and networks. And so it was that placelessness of that that I was personally exploring. And quite frankly, what got me there was literally taking my children out to parties and events at people's houses in areas I never would have gone to, getting lost as hell, but then starting to notice these huge complexes. And I thought, oh my God, let's drive over to one of these things, and didn't realize that almost nobody goes there except truck drivers and no one's talking about them. And on the New Jersey Turnpike, by this point, they were starting to pop up. Now they're everywhere and everyone's talking about them. But back then no one was talking about them. And I'm thinking, is anyone going to mention what's happening here? And so, yeah, it was emotional one, because I was sort of playing in a weird, I hate using this word, but I'm going to use it. I was sort of, it was like spatial slumming. I was slumming it. I was going into a, what was I perceived as a dangerous, disoriented place for the enjoyment of it in a strange way. Okay. So that was really kind of what that was about for me, making sense of a placelessness that I think is far more pervasive than just simply these locations on the edge of cities. I think it's really our current world, to be honest with you, but I won't go there. But I don't know if I answered your question, but that would have been kind of the emotional side to me.
I wondered if I could jump in and comment. I remember last time being fascinated both by your diagrams and your sense of space and place. And again, I was struck by it. But this time I was also struck by so many other interesting parallels and interconnections with my work on Islamic art and geometry. Mm-hmm. And two aspects in particular jump out. One is your use of intersections and interlacing and overlapping. And a second is the ambiguity that you play with between two and three dimensions. Mm-hmm. And the third relates to what you were just describing of your emotional, the emotional expressiveness that comes through. Maybe it doesn't come through except when you describe it. But for me, there's an effort in your work to excerpt something finite from what is infinite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which again could be an interesting way of describing so much of Islamic art, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, honestly, when I was preparing for this, I was very aware of that influence, and I purposely kept it out because I was so mindful of just running on so long. I already ran on longer than I should have anyway. So I made a point to. So, but since you brought it up, it's had a huge influence. One of the most powerful experiences of my life was when I was 20 years old. I went to Tunisia, and I ended up hitchhiking by myself across Tunisia and across Algeria, which back then in the 70s, and perhaps now too, I don't know. But I can tell you at the time, there weren't too many Americans crossing Algeria. I got an 8-day thing, but I came close to death a couple of times. That's another story, being robbed at knife point, stuff like that. Went to Morocco, spent a lot of time in Morocco, and my first introduction to the Islamic world and places like Fez in particular was just absolutely, I was just blown away by the art I was seeing at that time. Eventually going up to Granada, and taking a picture while I was in Granada at that time with an old camera with a particular little section of the wall of an, it's not even a particularly prominent, it's more of a background, you know, Granada could be, some areas are just really blowing you away, others are more passive. It was a passive area. I was intrigued by it, I took it. And in my studio to this day, I have a big printed blow up of that little thing. It's an interlace, very, very
simple. I was just gonna say.
Yeah, and it's right there. And that, especially that last series I showed you there, it is directly influenced by Islamic design.
Well, that's interesting too, because I also perceive, but I didn't know whether it was just me.
Yeah, just
something that was a great affinity to Arabic script, and mm-hmm. it was Arabic script in Andalusia in terms of the angles and the lines and the interlacing.
In fact, I got a travel grant about 3 years ago through my school to go to southern Spain, and I went back to Granada, first time since I was 20 years old, and mm-hmm. first thing I did is I had to find that wall. And I took another shot of it, you know, so that, and again, it wasn't even a particularly exciting part of the whole Granada, you know, but it was the part that just set the whole thing in motion for me. It's just that little piece. Thank you. Thanks for bringing that up.
Now, let us turn our attention to our dear Carol. And I don't know about you all, but I have to take a moment to go and grab my prop.
Okay, I took Farshid's invitation quite literally to talk about my work in progress. And what I thought I would do is draw you into my own decision-making process and ask for your comments and your suggestions, and hopefully figure out where to go from here. So the three projects that I want to bring to your attention just briefly lead me to think that I want to develop as my next project a book, and tentatively calling it a narrative approach to geometry in Islamic art, but I'm open to other suggestions. But what that comes out of is I finished a few months ago a draft for Encyclopedia of Islam, version 3 or 3rd edition, on geometry in Islamic art. Or maybe it was called geometry in art, but assumed Islamic. And I divided that essay into sections on plane and solid geometry, geometry, culture, and identity, and geometry, aesthetics, and meaning, and then the references. And what struck me as I was writing it was how many damn times I had to make reference to my own articles, and there were just a whole lot of articles. And it would have been so much easier if I just had one book to refer to and didn't have to refer to 15 articles. That was really a source of embarrassment. And then realizing as I was doing it that it seems like nobody has approached the subject as I have, where it's not isolating geometry and treating it as underlying structure of pattern, but looking at geometry in its cultural context and its cultural manifestation. And then two other projects, which I'll come to with only one slide, but I want to show you the images that accompany this particular article. And that is one that I'm just finishing also for Encyclopedia of Islam version 3 on ornament. And then the third, which actually I'll show second, is my early work from the mid-1990s on symmetry and pattern, The Art of Oriental Carpets, which was a website of about 200 pages that has just recently been taken down. And all of these intersect in what I would propose to do in a book on the subject. So my encyclopedia entry on geometry, here's the I guess it's the abstract of it, comprises a culturally specific component of an Islamic aesthetic in architecture and the arts. In the second, 8th centuries, preferences for symmetry and interlacing evolved from late Roman and Sasanian art, a formative period from the 9th to 12th century, demonstrates relationships between, as I argue, advances in mathematics and Islamic geometric patterns. And that relates in particular to the text that Katya just posted, as well as a couple of others. More study is needed in relating the textual and the visual traditions. Patterns with stars and polygons and overlapping intersecting polygonal networks exhibit multiple centers with underlying grids. Both periodic and quasi-periodic patterns are noteworthy from mathematical perspectives. Solid geometry manifests in vaults and domes. Innovations include the Mukarnas and Archnets. And then I begin the discussion with the stucco panel from Khibra Mafjar, which to me is the earliest firm evidence of use of compass and straight edge, and then marking off the sections of, in this case, a rhombic grid. And then I move very quickly to the intersecting arches and in two dimensions and the intersecting arches in three dimensions in Cordoba to introduce both two dimensionality and three dimensionality in the use of geometry. And then I make a comparison of what is actually constructed using compass and straight edge and what is executed by hand, not with compass and straight edge here, an example in embroidery. But there's also a geometric structure in the stringing of the warps, the tying of the warps in this rhesus dyed warp ikat from Yemen. And then the contrast again in cut bricks, but where there's a very specific articulation of geometry. I call it geometry made manifest. And elsewhere, I've argued in two articles addressing number, shape, and the nature of space. And all of my work so far is really on geometry in Islamic art, not more broadly and not more universally. But here, that articulation is intersecting networks of 12 pointed stars set within a hexagonal grid, an underlying hexagonal grid. And each of the 12 pointed stars is surrounding the name of God, Allah. So you have a tetractys, 4, 3, 2, 1, of the name of God in this tympanum from the mid 11th century. And then more broadly, the geometric structuring of space, and here the ambiguity of two dimensions and three dimensions, where you have, incidentally, the interlacing that we've seen is also that ambiguity because it's a rendered interlacing, not an actual interlacing. On the tower at Jam in Afghanistan, where not only is there interlacing of geometric shapes in the structure, but the actual patterning within each of those outlined circles or ovals or polygons with many, many different patterns. And the multiplicity of patterns is something that is absolutely critical to understanding an aesthetic, an algorithmic aesthetic in Islamic art. And then we have 17th century direct textual evidence for the training of architects in geometry, and in particular, training in the inlay of mother of pearl and tortoise shell, which led individuals to understand the architecture that pertained to architecture on a much grander scale. And a speculation that even the teacher of the person who wrote that text, the great architect Sinan, that his tomb may actually, which he designed, may actually be in plan the representation of a pair of compass dividers. That's a fascinating speculation. And then, let me see if I can go back. A recent speculation of the Tower of Gumbadi Kabus being in alignment with the sun at the solstice, and the decagonal, that is the 10 flanges fitting within a decagon within a circle of the base, being a three-dimensional prismatic geometric structure that is in alignment literally with the universe and with light. And then I did a study of a bunch of Quranic inscriptions on monuments that I argue link the presentation of, or the expression of, geometric patterns to Quranic terms in the selections that are illustrated on a number of monuments that suggests possibly that the plural amsal refers not to parables and similes as is usually translated, but literally to the geometric patterns as geometric problems. And then again, the two-dimensional, three-dimensional relationship, the plan of a Mukarnas in two dimensions incised on a gypsum plaque that is documenting in diagrammatic form the three-dimensional structure of Mukarnas, internally segmented vaults. Then there's in the literature a sense that, okay, the geometry and even all the sciences died with the Mongol conquests and then shifted to Europe. But I wanted to show, this is an artistic rendering by Mamun Sakal, but it documents again in a diagrammatic form all of the different ways that squares are intersected for the use of Kufic script in Bibi Khanum Mosque in Samarkand, but it also reflects the use of intersecting squares on the on oblique grid in Timurid monuments more generally, so up into 15th century. Then the reappearance in the 15th century of intersecting arches in the construction of domes in Iran, namely the use of what's called karbandi, and their rendering in two-dimensional plans showing the arrangement of the intersection of arches and the divisions of the circle, which contribute to that division of space. So that's the sequence of what I've covered in my article on geometry in Islamic art, where I really decided to focus specifically on geometry and the articulation of geometry. I dropped my pen, but that makes me realize I forgot about the interactive that was part of this. What I'd like you to do is take the circle that you have and place two marks on it, on the circumference, anywhere on the circumference, two marks using a pen or a pencil or a marker or a crayon. And then what I'd like you to do is fold the plates so that one mark is right on top of the other mark?
My paper plate is three-dimensional, pointing out the fact that geometry is always embodied.
Brad. So when you put the two marks on the circumference and folded one point over the other point, hold up what is the result. Oh. Anybody notice something interesting? We didn't put all of our marks at exactly the same place.
But you still get the same shape.
You still get the same shape. So everybody got a semicircle as a result. Now, why is that? No matter where you put the mark, the two marks, why is it that you get a semicircle? So what happens is when you put one point on top of the other, as Laura said, you're playing with symmetry, but before you even get to the symmetry, putting the two points one on top of another, you are creating a chord. And every chord, no matter where it is bisected by a diameter. And that's where the symmetry comes in. Laura introduces, Kalpana maybe introduced pleasure of ornament and what is the role of pleasure. And I think pleasure, beauty, art, meaning all, we need to scrutinize our definitions and scrutinize our assumptions. And in preparing this article on ornament, what I've come up with is there is so much work that just assumes, without articulating, assumes those Western dichotomies of representational, non-representational, ornamental and decorative versus representational or figural. But they don't come out and say it. And another one that I've come up with is Grabar, for whom I have enormous respect for his work and his questions without answers, but they lead us to think, is his assumption, and he does articulate it, he questions it. If geometry is universal and available to all, why was it so particularly fascinating to artists in the Islamic world? And I still don't have fully an answer to it, but I think that that point of intersection of art and mathematics, or history of art, history of architecture, and history of mathematics, I would argue, but I have to fill it out, led to a discovery of two-dimensional space, which goes far beyond Euclid. And which for me is as significant a moment in cultural history as the Renaissance discovery of perspective. Mm-hmm. And the same way that Western art ever since, until a reversion in the 20th century, focused on that perspective rendering of three dimensions in two, Islamic art and architecture in ornament focused on that structuring of two-dimensional space. But all the evidence is visual. We don't have any textual explications such as Alberti on perspective, writing about it. We don't have that textual support, at least not to our present knowledge. Katya, you may be more familiar with textual sources that may render illumination for us on pattern and patterning and two-dimensional space.
Yeah, I'll just quickly jump in with a couple of comments. I really love your way of questioning ornament and talking about articulation of geometry and this kind of ambiguity between two and three dimensional space. I think one thing we should bear in mind that the majority of the examples of Islamic architecture that we see now are not what they would have been perceived like in their when they would have been constructed. So for example, if we think of the Alhambra, we know that it was not this kind of very subtle, delicate, monochrome kind of ornamentation with, you know, very lovely whites and off-whites. It would have been very, very colorful. And on top of all the stucco decorations, there would have been loads and loads of textiles, textile hangings and weavings. So it was an incredibly lavish and an incredible visual experience, which points to this understanding of pleasure, you know, what is pleasure, what is kind of visual satisfaction, and also talks about this mentality of adornment and ornamentation, where you know, the buildings were seen to be adorned. You know, it was they were understood. You know, we have still this tradition of clothing the Kaaba. We also have buildings in Cairo that are still draped in very colorful fabrics. And we know from a lot of the cultures in the Middle East, you know, how much clothes matter. You know, it's a status symbol. So in a way, you know, ornament and architecture is, there's a lot about, you know, it's a statement about status, and there's a lot about patronage and funding and how those projects came about. But it is, it's ornament in space, you know, as well as surface. So I think maybe thinking in terms of clothing can be a really interesting way of kind of understanding this. And another comment is, and I don't know how much you take this into consideration, but I would just caution against taking a primarily kind of Anglophone approach to, well, mm-hmm. You've just brought it up, you know, what is the terminology in Turkish and Persian? And I've really benefited from, as a Russian speaker, from the Russian scholarship on Islamic art and architecture. And there's a huge difference from many, many publications in the last 20, 30 years on Islamic art and architecture, where geometry alone is never studied as a completely separate kind of line of thinking. You know, it is always taken in the context of spatial geometry. So there's geometry that unfolds in space as well as surface decorations. And I think there's a lot in Persian scholarship and Arabic scholarship and Russian scholarship that we do not have access to. And it really needs to be taken into account. And Laura, your question about this controlling the space and definition of ornament, you know, how much of it is to do with the English language and kind of the general dominance of the English language in the modern academe.